The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.
We're in conversation with Rebecca Wahlberg, social policy analyst at the Frontier Center for Public Policy, talking about a study that just came out looking at Canada's a comparison of the Canadian healthcare system and various European countries and their healthcare systems, and looking at, as we're talking off the air with Ms. Wahlberg, there are hours and hours of data to talk about in this, and so I wanted to focus on things that people are usually exposed to in Canada in terms of what people tend to talk about a lot, and that was, and you were alluding to this in the past segment. Access to specialists and family doctors, and how we rank with regards to what is happening in Europe.
That's right. Well, we rank overall, actually. I don't think we talked about this yet. We come in 23rd out of 30, compared with all of the countries in the study. And what I found sobering was that all of the countries that we beat are Eastern European countries that have had to rebuild their whole systems in the past 20 years.
That says something.
I find that, you know, without intending any insult to these Eastern European countries, that's not the league we should be playing in.
No.
I mean, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We have a very high standard of living. We've had peace, you know, ever since 1867. There's no reason why we should be struggling to keep up with countries that have had to start rebuilding from scratch.
How did we fare in the realm of new medications in terms of approval of the medications and then the provision of those on the formularies within the provinces? Because this has been, there have been groups in Canada that are very concerned, some cancer advocacy groups, pain management groups, things, people talking about how difficult it is to access medications that are approved and yet provincial governments don't pay for them.
Yes, that was one of the five categories we looked at, was access to pharmaceuticals, and Canada did pretty poorly there. And we looked at four different indicators. The first was how much pharmaceutical use is subsidized by the government. How much does the government pay to help people access drugs? And the best performing states in Europe actually find that over 90% of their prescription costs are met by public funds one way or another. In Canada, the equivalent number is 38%. So that's phenomenal. That's something that our European counterparts have found astonishing, to be honest, was how stingy the system is in terms of providing medicine. And this is important for a couple of reasons. The first is obviously that people suffer. I mean, using drugs effectively, it can cure people. For people with chronic conditions, it can relieve their suffering, improve their quality of life. So there's the human suffering aspect of it. But the other aspect, and when we're constantly hearing about healthcare deficits in terms of the budget, is it's not cost effective. It's been proven that for every dollar that you spend using drugs appropriately, you reduce other treatment costs by over $2. But there are other obstacles to using pharmaceuticals properly in Canada, and one of them is access to information. One of the things we asked is there a layman-adapted pharmacopoeia or formulary? And what we mean by this is, how easy is it for the average interested layman, someone with no medical education who's just interested in the drugs he's been prescribed, how easy is it to find out what drugs are covered and under what circumstances? Because some drugs are only covered if they're prescribed for certain conditions. And we found it's very hard to get this information. There are a couple of provinces in which you actually have to pay money and order a physical copy that's mailed to you. So this involves a degree of expense and hassle and delay. A lot of provinces have formularies that are available online, but they're not intended for the layman. They list only trade names for drugs, and this isn't helpful to most people. Most people don't need the chemical name of the drug. They need to know what it's going to be called when they buy it at the drugstore and by what name it's commonly known. And then there's the question of, can you get the drugs at all, even if you know what they're called? Now, in terms of new cancer-fighting drugs, we rank about average compared to the European countries in terms of how long it takes to start using effective new cancer-fighting agents. So that's not bad news, but it could be a lot better. There have been a couple cases in Manitoba recently where people have been unable to get the most effective drug that's been proven to work in the States and Europe against their cancer that's extremely expensive, and the government won't pay for it. And then the other question is more broadly, so that's looking just at cancer-fighting drugs. For other drugs, we ask how long does it take before it's included in the formulary, and we do very poorly for that. It takes on average 384 days. It takes over a year between when a drug is first available for prescription in a province and when that drug's included in the province's formulary. So what that means is that if you can't afford a new drug, and newest drugs are the most likely to be expensive, you can't get appropriate treatment mm-hmm. for over a year because of this bureaucratic delay.
And then you deteriorate and it costs even more later on to treat you.
Yes, I mean, the worst case scenario is you can't get the drug you need and your condition becomes fatal. But right. for most people, it's not that bad. But it does mean that they suffer. They're in more pain. They take longer to get better. They have to wait longer to be treated and their condition worsens and, of course, costs more to treat. So, yes, it's very inefficient, both in terms of human suffering and in terms of cost management.
Now, where Canada focused on, and I'm returning back to those five areas with regards to wait times, because I know that this was looked at in the report. How did Canada fare with the addition of funding in those areas compared to the European countries?
For the procedures that we looked at for wait times?
Yeah, cardiac bypass, joint replacement, MRI access, and cancer care.
For all of those, we scored in the lowest category. For access to elective cardiac surgery, so that's elective bypass and also angioplasty, we scored almost at the cutoff, so just barely in the failing grade, but mm-hmm. still below the pass mark. For all the others, it was much worse. For the hip and knee replacement, we had very long wait times, and this is especially distressing when you consider that that area was the recipient
right.
of a lot of federal funding. And then for MRI scans, we were far over the benchmark that was set as well. And for cancer treatment, and this is significant, what we looked at is how long does it take to begin cancer treatment, and we took the average of all three of the most common methods, surgical treatment, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. And we get a failing grade there as well. And there is a rough correlation, and we want to do more work on this in the future, but there is a rough correlation between how soon you start treating cancer and five-year survival rates. Mm-hmm. This is an area that's very time-sensitive.
So I guess my question is, where did Canada score well?
Well, there were some bright spots.
Yeah.
The good news is, in terms of outcomes, we score a bit above average. There's we had five categories for outcomes, and for the first is heart attack mortality. So what we look at is the 30-day mortality rate for an AMI, a heart attack, and we score extremely well for that. And that's really good news. The reason we chose that indicator is that the 30-day mortality rate tends to reflect how well you're treated when the ambulance picks you up, when you mm-hmm. get into the hospital immediately. If we looked at the longer-term mortality rate, that tends to reflect more how well do you follow the doctor's orders, do you lose the weight, give up smoking, whatever it is that you're told to do. So that's not really a measure of the healthcare system. But the 30-day mortality rate does measure very well how effectively the hospital treats you. So that's a very good sign that we score that well.
Mm-hmm.
We score extremely well there, actually. I think we're about the third best out of all the 30 countries for heart attack mortality rates. For infant mortality, we score average, and this is true. There's now the conventional measure of infant mortality has been the raw score per 1,000 births. There are some people now who are using infant mortality per 1,000 births over 500 grams,
right.
simply because for extreme prematurity or multiple births, the mortality rate goes up significantly.
Mm-hmm.
But even by that measure, in fact, we're still just average. So, and this is an important indicator. A lot of people take this as a measurement of a lot of things. But, you know, when we talk about third world countries, the infant mortality rate is appallingly high because that's one of the most important things you can do with your healthcare resources, right?
Right.
So, you know, average is not bad, but it's also not really something to congratulate ourselves on too much. And then in terms of cancer five-year survival rates, we look there at taken together prostate cancer, breast cancer, and intestinal cancer, and we get for that an average rate as well for five-year survival. And then the other bright spot in outcomes, we get full marks for PYLL, potential years of life lost. And this is a bit dry compared to things like infant mortality or heart attack mortality, but this is an actuarial measure of avoidable death. So it looks at how many years would people live if they had gotten ideal treatment and if everything had gone right, and we score very well for that. And then the other measurement for which we get an average score in outcomes is the prevalence of MRSA, multiply resistant mm-hmm. staph A. And we score well here. We get an average score. There's two things, though, that I'd point out here. The first is that this is data that dates back to 1999. And every other country we've looked at for which we have more recent data, there's been a really sharp uptick in MRSA prevalence. The other thing is that MRSA was chosen because this is a big issue in Europe. It is present in Canada, but the bigger issue here is C. difficile in terms of nosocomial bacterial infections. So this is something, when we look at the interprovincial index, we'll probably look more at C. difficile, and that will give us more specific information about hygiene practices and infections within hospital in the Canadian context.
What I also found interesting is that it did look at the two different funding systems in Europe. I thought that was very telling in that there were advantages to each of them, but yet they still were able to say that one tended to provide a little bit better result than others. Could you get into briefly about the funding systems, just very briefly, what they're called and,
right.
and how people deal with it?
Well, social services in general tend to be provided along two lines. They both date back to the late 19th century. One's called Beveridge, and it's after a model that evolved in Britain. The other is Bismarck, which evolved, not surprisingly, in Germany.
Right.
And the difference is that Beveridge systems usually have a single payer, and often that single payer has a monopoly or a high degree of control over the provision of care as well. So that's what we have in Canada, with a couple of exceptions like workers' comp. All medical treatment is paid for by the provincial governments, and with other minor exceptions, like cosmetic surgery clinics, all care is provided through doctors and hospitals who work directly for the provincial health authorities.
Right.
The Bismarck system, on the other hand, has a range of purchasers and payers and also of providers. So what this means is that, and this doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have private medicine. This
Right.
is, of course, one of the questions that always comes up. Are you recommending we have private medicine? And that's really not relevant to what we're talking about. All of these methods can be done in a public system or in a private system. A lot of European states, for instance, have a number of different models of government-provided insurance, and you can choose the one that you want. So that means there are different insurers through the government, all of which are publicly available, but they still give you a degree of choice. You can choose the plan that suits you the best, and they also allow choice and competition. And choice and competition tend to be the key to improving both outcomes in terms of the quality of medical care and also cost effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the list of all 30 of the countries arranged top to bottom, and we can graph their performance, the top five are all Western continental states, and they are also, and this is significant, Bismarck states. So it's not a coincidence that the top five are all Bismarck states.
Mm-hmm.
The next one down is Sweden, which is the highest performing Beveridge state. And Sweden is still pretty good. I mean, it still gets a very high score, significantly higher than Canada. So in our policy recommendation section, ideally Canada would adopt the advantages of the Bismarck systems. In reality, any change that increased the degree of choice and competition would be a step forward.
Right.
But even within a Beveridge system, there is a tremendous amount of room for improvement.
Now, will this be an ongoing evaluation? That is, will we see another report next year with Canada included? Is this now going to be a routine once
Absolutely,
a year thing?
Yes.
Terrific.
This is the first annual, and we also have another project that's linked to this. Later in 2008, we're going to be releasing the first annual Inter-Canadian Health Consumer Index, and we're going to be looking at all of the provinces, and we'll be using a lot of the same indicators and also some new ones, and we're going to be ranking the provinces because there's also a tremendous variance within the provinces in terms of how we deal on these indicators. So for this study, we took the weighted average. We looked at the performance of each province and then weighted it according to the share of the population. And for some indicators, the performance was fairly uniform, but for others there was a tremendous difference. And so we can learn internally as well. We can make some great policy recommendations by looking at, you know, what does Ontario do the best and how can we imitate that? And Ontario can look at the rest of us and see what it could improve, for instance.
Well, Ms. Wahlberg, I'm looking forward to having you back on to talk about that study as well, and also on a yearly basis to talk about what I consider to be a very refreshing look at analyzing our healthcare system. And It really is an unbiased report. That's what I like about it. It just gets to looking at what's best for patients, provides an index, doesn't care whether the systems are public or private or a mixture of both, but rather looks at the results and the outcomes in many different areas. And I encourage our listeners to look at this report. And where could they get a copy of this report if they wanted to?
It's available online at our website, the Frontier Center website, which is www.fcpp.org, and also at our European counterpart, the Health Consumer Powerhouse, at www.healthconsumerpowerhouse.com. And yes, we've striven to look from the perspective of the consumer, and we're not really interested in the method by which funding is provided. All industrialized countries tend to spend about 7 to 10% of their GDP on healthcare, and the lead researcher in Europe is fond of saying that we couldn't care less what method is used to channel 7 to 10% into healthcare. What we care about is how it's perceived by the consumer. How effective is that money once it is delivered, not how is it delivered.
Ms. Wahlberg, it's wonderful talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Rebecca Wahlberg is social policy analyst at the Frontier Center for Public Policy. And again, you can get a copy of that report at fcpp.org, fcpp.org. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call.